Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 229 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.fm has voicemail, call 862-800-6805, and as well as leaving a message or question for the show, leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, or don't. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from you, my listeners. Don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Or commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, liberapay.com, where we are also Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on any of the topics you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now let's go to this week's interview. Claire Graham is an advocate for people with intersex conditions and is open about being one herself. She's also a trained teacher who works with disabled children who cannot attend school, and she has a law degree. Today we will talk about intersex conditions and how this is affected by the current focus on transgender issues. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Hi, nice to speak to you.
It's great for you to join me. So I wanted to start by dealing with some terminology, because I think most people don't think about intersex conditions and don't know all of the different terminology, what it means and when it should be used. So intersex, DSD, and hermaphrodite, can you explain what they mean and when they should be used?
Yeah, okay. So I'll start with hermaphrodite, because to an extent that's the easiest. In human beings, there's really no such thing as a hermaphrodite. Hermaphrodite means someone who can produce sperm and ova. There are no people that are doing both of those things. But it used to be used as a diagnostic label for people with intersex conditions, but it was used more to hide what their real condition was. It's like a word that was used to mask other things in their medical notes. So some intersex people have reclaimed the word and they choose to use it. Some do not like the word at all because it's really inaccurate. So for that word to be used, really, it's up to... It's an individual thing, so it shouldn't be used by anyone who isn't intersex, and it's and if you are using it, you need to make sure that the person you're referring to is happy with that label. Intersex is kind of the umbrella term. I think most people think it means someone who's in between male and female. It's just an umbrella term for a collective of different medical conditions that affect someone's reproductive development. When the term was first coined, it wasn't supposed to mean in between. It was about how different factors interplay when our reproductive system develops. So, you know, there's hormones, there's chromosomes, there's lots of things that have to do exactly the right thing for normal, I'm doing inverted commas, I know you can't see it, but, you know, normal development to happen.
Right.
Then DSD is the medical term, which is a term that you would most likely see used in medical literature now and in scientific literature. It's in those places, it stands for disorders that are sexually development. A lot of intellect people don't like the word disorder because it implies that you need fixing. So most intellectual organisations that use the term DSD, they mean it to mean different affect development rather than disorder affect development. For intersex and DSD, again, it's quite an individual. Some intersex people don't mind the word intersex. Some really dislike it because of the, you know, the images that it creates for people. I prefer the term DSD.
The problem I have with intersex is that it kind of implies that intersex people are not clearly men or women, but I think in the majority of cases, it's very clear that they're either male or female.
There may be factors that make that more confusing or that, you know, more difficult to determine than it would be with someone who doesn't have a DSD. But most people with DSDs are unambiguously male or female, which is why a lot of them don't like the word intersex. It wasn't a word until I started getting more involved in advocacy. It wasn't a word I really used for myself because it didn't feel like it described my condition because I'm unambiguously female. And again, I had the same sort of misconceptions as other people about the word. I use it now because it's something that people understand. So when, if I say I'm an intersex advocate, people have an idea of what it might be that I'm talking about.
Right. Well, let's talk about your personal situation a little bit. When did you find out that you had an intersex condition? And is it better to say, when did you find out that you were intersex or that you had an intersex condition? Like, do you have a preference there?
I think either is fine. I don't really mind with that.
Okay.
So I didn't know something was wrong until I was a teenager and my puberty started and started, like, my external development started as normal, and then I didn't get my period. So because I was still quite young, my mum put off referring me to the doctors because obviously there was going to be a lot of intimate examinations that she wanted me to wait till a bit later in life for those. So I was referred to from my GP to the local hospital at the age of 16, and I had about 2 years of different tests. I had scans and blood tests and all sorts of things, and in the end I had surgery. And then I was 18 when I was diagnosed with, well, I wasn't told I had MRKH. I was told, I literally come out of surgery, so it's a little bit hazy for me. I came around and they just sort of said, you haven't got a uterus, you haven't got a cervix, and, you know, you won't ever have children, and then just sort of sent me home.
How was the impact on you at that point? Like, that seems like a pretty heavy, maybe as a teenager it's not so significant, but, I mean, that's a pretty heavy load, I think, for a lot of people to get dumped on them.
Yeah, it's changed over time. When I first was told, I was quite sort of philosophical because, you know, it was one of those, like, I hadn't lost anything. It was how I'd always been. I just didn't know.
Right.
But then, I mean, obviously you face some big questions then. I'd come from a big family and I'd always believed I would be a mum.
Right.
And, you know, believed I would be a mum by the normal route as well. I went through a phase of not really understanding, you know, worrying would I be rejected because I couldn't have children.
Right.
How would I tell people if I was going to be in a relationship with someone, how would I talk to them about that? And sort of what would my future look like, because it wasn't the future that I'd had in my mind.
Right.
But, you know, at 18, you're quite resilient, I still.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was an adult technically, but you've still got a lot of, you know, your whole life ahead of you, really. Equally, at that age, I had the thing that, you know, it sort of saved me money on contraception with my boyfriend because I can't get pregnant.
When I started looking at some of these intersex things, I read an article about a Spanish athlete. I don't know if you know about her, but she discovered that she was an XY female because she showed up at an international meet. And she didn't have her paperwork saying that she was a woman, even though she was clearly anatomically a woman. And so they did a chromosomal test and said, you're a man, and sent her home. She was later reinstated, based on anatomy, I guess. Her fiancé dumped her at that point. I guess, you know, I don't know if it was just he was horrified that he was sleeping with a a man, even though she was a woman, or if it was because he wanted children and she was going to be infertile.
Yeah, it's difficult to know. And I, when I was a teenager, I did, for a while, I've managed to find some really sketchy information about intersex conditions. Mine is very rarely mentioned because it's, I think probably to an extent because it is more straightforward. So I'd convinced myself, or I would convince myself and then forget about it, that they were going to come back and tell me I was male. And I remember trying to work out how I would... I thought if they told me that, I had to tell other people. So I imagine going around having to say to everyone, like, I'm a man now, and you have to, him thrown out. And obviously, that's not what happened, but that was, the sort of worry.
Yes, and I mean, your condition is not... is sort of different than, say, Caster Semenya, the athlete, because Caster Semenya has male chromosomes. So, it's understandable that people say, well, is she a man or a woman? I go down on the side of anatomy, just like the athlete in the 1980s wrote an article in Lancet, and she said, I am a woman, I have breasts like a woman, and I have a vagina. I'm not a man, right? Anatomically, I'm a woman. But people are so obsessed with chromosomes that they think, oh, okay, Caster Semenya is a man. But in your case, there's really no issue.
It's quite difficult. I think, the whole debate around gender has been really hard for XY women because they've got sort of caught up in, trans women and men, as people will say in that. And then they sort of, people like, especially Caster, because come around at the same time, and people get really hooked on that XY so man. But as you say, when they're people like that, they're born and they have a vagina and they look like any other girl, and they go their whole life till they're diagnosed, believing themselves to be as female as the girl sitting next to them. I don't see any reason why that would be. Obviously, teenage me is just very confused. I don't, as an adult, understand it better. I don't see why any reason why we don't respect the female designation on their birth certificate, because that's how they appear. I mean, you wouldn't know. You could sit next to a girl with tape on the bust and you wouldn't know.
Right. And even more amazing, I found somebody sent me an article, a scientific article, about an XY woman who got pregnant normally and had a child, and her daughter was XY, and I believe also had a child. So here you have a woman...
I think I've read that case.
So you have a woman who has male chromosomes who is able to get pregnant. So there is nothing about her except her chromosomes that is male.
I think she had a mosaic. I think she had XYXO chromosomes. It's the case that I'm thinking of. Again, people get really confused by that because if her reproductive development wasn't driven by XY, then everything about her will be female. And she obviously didn't know. I think it wasn't until she'd given birth and there was a complication and testing was done and then it was discovered.
It reminds me of in the 1950s, engineers analyzed bees and decided that bees can't fly. They might have said to her, you could not have had a child because you don't have female chromosomes.
Yeah.
But she did.
And yet here we are.
When did you decide that you obviously spent some time accepting your condition and planning your life, maybe differently than you'd thought, but you seem to have done that very maturely. When did you decide to go the step further and be an advocate for other intersex people, and maybe even more importantly, the parents of newly born intersex children who may be, really distressed by the situation or having a hard time finding information?
It wasn't really until I got involved in the gender discussion, because I kept seeing my condition, specifically my condition, women without wombs we talked about all the time. And I responded to that by just sort of writing about how I felt about it. And then from that, initially it was just other people with DSDs got in touch and just said, including women with CASE and women with other syndrome, and some men as well. They got in touch and said that they felt the same. So I started writing about the science behind intersex and how the developmental differences happen to try to debunk some of the ideas that are pushed by like the gender theorist.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started sharing information, that's when families started getting in touch with me. And I realized there was, you know, the gap there as well with parents, that we don't talk about parents and how important they actually are. They're, you know, one of the things that intersex advocates talk about all the time is the surgery on infants. Well, of course, it's parents that make those decisions. So I think it's really important that we, as a community, include parents in what we're doing, because they're the decision makers.
I first talked about this. Have you heard of a woman, Alice Drager?
Yes.
So I interviewed Alice Drager a while ago, and she talked a little bit about these surgery things. But I felt that what was happening is that the parents were completely floored by this. This is like the last thing they expected. It had never crossed their mind that they might have an intersex child. And it was really the doctors making the decision. The doctors are saying, okay, we got to fix this right away.
Yeah, I think, having spoken to parents, I think, because it's such a lot of people don't realise when a child is born with ambiguous genitalia, it's actually a medical emergency, not because the genitalia itself necessarily poses a health risk, although, you know, if it would prevent urination or something, that obviously there's a health risk with that. But one of the conditions, CIH, which could cause ambiguous genitalia only in females, males with CIH don't have ambiguous genitalia, it can be fatal because it can cause salt wasting.
Okay.
So as soon as a child is seen to have ambiguous genitalia, doctors have to investigate the cause of it because they need to intervene.
In some cases, but not in every case, right?
No. But they would have to run the diagnostics test whether mm-hmm, it was a case mm-hmm. that needed intervention or a case that wasn't. So straight away, there's going to be blood tests and scans and lots of things happening to your newborn baby. And, you know, everyone wants, if you had a boy or girl, and you can't answer the question. So parents are incredibly traumatized, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're thrown into this world where there's so much information that none of us would understand unless we'd looked into it, because it's so complex. And yeah, I think you end up guided by doctors. We can do this for you, we can do that for you, you know, and you've got a child with a rare medical condition who you're going to listen to. Of course, you're going to listen to the doctors.
Right.
You'd
mm-hmm.
assume they're doing what's best for your child.
Well,
I know in the UK that they try to move away from it, from being aggressive with surgery,
mm-hmm.
and trying to be more sort of holistic and balanced with it.
Right. So, I mean, if we carve out the cases where there's a genuine medical emergency, I think most people would agree that the doctors need to do something, and there's really no question, there's not really a choice there in terms of should we do something or not. But when I was talking to Alice Drager, it seemed like a lot of the thing was, okay, this is a girl with an enlarged clitoris, so we should fix it now. Because she's going to be embarrassed when she's older, but of course we don't really know what that girl is going to feel like. Later, whether that will be a problem for her or not.
It's quite complicated when you look at, again, because there are different conditions that cause ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
CIH, which is the most common and which is the one that predominantly affects females. When you look at it, and it's such a contentious subject that I always worry about talking about this and getting the tone right. When you look at research, you talk to girls with CIH, who have had surgery, and girls with CIH who haven't, most of them actually prefer the surgery when they're younger. Now, it depends what surgery's happened. If it's that sometimes in the past they would perform a clitorectomy, you know, when they would remove the clitoris. Obviously, most girls who have had that done aren't happy with it because that removes all sensation. But reduction surgery, most girls would prefer that had happened at a younger age rather than an older age. So I think what's quite difficult is it's all got put together in one.
Can you explain what CIH is? Because I don't know.
Congenital adrenal hyperplasia. It's when someone produces too much testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
So it is something that can happen to boys and girls, but a boy producing too much testosterone generally not a problem. Girls producing testosterone, what that means is when they're developing in utero, like their clitoris will realize, so it becomes bigger and it can look a bit more like it's not a penis, but it looks like a penis.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes their labia, they fume, so it looks like a scrotal sac, and it isn't a scrotal sac, but it can appear like one because it hasn't opened up,
right. It
hasn't opened for the vaginal opening. So that's what that means. And then in puberty, girls with a condition that, you know, they can grow like more facial hair and body hair than they would wish to. Again, you know, more masculine traits, they would be part of their development. But other than that, I mean, they have XX chromosomes, they have ovaries, most, I think, menstruate, most are fertile. It's just this excess testosterone that causes a difference to their appearance.
Right. So anatomical shift a little bit towards the male, but still vast majority of characteristics are female. And I mean, as you say, that if the surgery is done for social reasons, right? Like this, there's no physical reason why a woman with this condition can't have sex and have a baby and all those things. But, you know, socially, she might feel, when she's intimate with a man, she might feel, he might feel weird,
she might
and she'll feel weird.
Yeah. Sometimes there is some, for CAH women, there is some surgery that might have to happen. If they have a fused labia, for their period to happen as normal, that would need like a surgical intervention to open the vagina. There's discussions about whether that should happen when they're babies, because then, I mean, there's arguments about this. We've got all surgery on infants for like birth defects, for want of a better word. You know, when is the best time to do it? Is it when they're younger, so they heal quicker and they forget and just get on with their lives? Or is it better to wait till they're older? So there's some discussion with girls with CAH of whether this should be done when they're babies, whether we should wait until puberty is getting closer, and then that would be the time to do it.
Right.
There's just not a lot, because the decision hasn't always been in the hands of intersex people and their parents. There isn't necessarily the research out there. And doctors chose one path for a long time, and that was surgery. So there aren't really sort of comparable things to look at. You know, here's one cohort that didn't have it, here's one that did, and this, you know, and look at the outcomes and which was better. It's really difficult to
to do an experiment where, you know, one arm is going to have surgery within the first year,
and the second
one at maybe 14. You know, that would be a 20-year study, and it couldn't be blinded, because obviously the girls who'd have the surgery as a baby would know that surgery had been done, or the parents would know anyway. I think one of the problems with surgery is not cases like this. Obviously, if the uterus is not, if the vagina is covered by the fused labia, then that obviously needs to be fixed. I think there were doctors who were saying, okay, there's ambiguity here, so we think this is a girl, we think it's a boy, and then they would do surgery under that assumption, and it would prove to be wrong.
Yeah. So, well, I don't think it was necessarily under an assumption, and I think this is where the word hermaphrodite started to appear in medical records. Often what would happen is, if a male was born and he had a significantly small penis, or he had quite a severe hyperphagia, which is where urethra opens on the underside of the penis instead of at the tip, doctors would sort of look at that and say, well, this is no good as a penis. And then they would remove the penis and create a vagina, and that child would be raised a female. And I definitely think, in terms of surgery, that's definitely something that should be stopped. Those people would, more often than not, they would be lied to. And like I say, so they would be given the diagnosis of hermaphrodite, which would make it appear as though doctors didn't know if they were male or female, but that word was just used to mask the decision the doctors had made.
Right, so the child was clearly male, but the doctor saying, well, you know, this child doesn't really have the equipment to be a, ironic quotes, you know, true man, so we'll turn them into a girl. But of course, you know, there's a lot more to being a man than just your external genitalia, or vice versa.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, to me, this is where there's a little bit of a crossover between intersex and transgender issues, because in these cases where, say, a boy had surgery, was brought up as a girl, at some point the child said, I'm a boy. And there was this innate belief that I'm a boy, because anatomically they had been until, say, their penis was removed. And, of course, transgender people say, you know, I'm a boy, I'm a girl. What's the difference? Like, that's the question we need to answer.
Oh, that's a good question. I think the main difference is that actually, if it's an intersex person who had whose sex was assigned, then they are actually speaking a biological truth about themselves. Mm-hmm. I have a slight issue in the idea that it would be completely innately what the child knew of themselves, because I think it's probably quite likely. If you're a child who's been given surgery and the adults around you know that this has happened, even if they're doing their best to keep it from you, I think there are probably clues that tell you that something is different about you. Mm-hmm. And therefore, and children are quite perceptive, you know, they will find out, and children have big ears. They will, you know, they hear the conversations about themselves. And so I'm never sure when you hear about these things, how much that has come completely from innately from in the child, and how much they have picked up from those around them that something is different about themselves, and they've started to piece together that might be. Right. So I think that's what sets it apart, is there is this physical thing about that person. I know that trans activists then say that this means that I'm saying that that means that they're more valid. I just think it means that it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a physicality. It is, and it's something that we could, you know, we could measure, we can observe it, you could use chromosomes, or you could check the gonads, but you know, whatever, and that would tell us the sex of the person, and that what they're saying about themselves is actually true.
Right. Whereas, and even if a doctor had, you know, constructed a vagina for this boy, as the boy grew into puberty, they would start to mature as a boy, right? Their breasts would not enlarge.
They would need to take estrogen to go through a female puberty. Yeah.
Right.
More often than not, when genital surgery is performed, it means they remove the gonads as well, so the person wouldn't be able to produce whichever hormone they needed to go through surgery.
To go through puberty.
So, to go through puberty. So they would require some sort of intervention to help them with that, yeah. Would need, if it was a boy who'd been assigned, surgically assigned female, he would need, or she would need estrogen to induce female puberty.
And this is not something that could happen to a girl, right? Like, even a girl with an enlarged clitoris, I mean, a doctor couldn't say, well, we'll just treat it like a penis, because obviously the girl couldn't urinate through the enlarged clitoris, so you can you?
Some girls in the past with enlarged, who were extremely virilized, were assigned male and raised as boys. That happens less now because we understand that they're female, and you know, there's nothing wrong with being female and having excess testosterone. So it doesn't happen as often now, but it did happen in the past. And there have been cases, I know there's been a whole thing at the moment about, you know, because there's Jessica Yaniv who claimed to be male and have periods. Right. So there's been a discussion about that. And I came across, there was one case of a man in China who presented at the doctors, and they were experiencing bleeding, and it turned out they were a female with CAH, but when they were born they looked male, so they were recorded as male. Right. and that's what they believed themselves to be until they went to the doctors, and it turns out the bleeding was periods, and that's what that was. So that there have been some cases of virilized women who have either just been recorded as male because that's what was believed, or who, even though it was known they were female, were raised as male.
Interesting. So what have your interactions been with the transgender community? Because it sounds like they haven't always been completely positive. from some of the things you've written?
It's been quite mixed. I know some trans people who are incredibly supportive. Equally, because I talk very much about intersex as the different conditions and the different effects they have rather than the sex spectrum, which is what trans activists like to use. They don't like that because it counters their science. So it's been quite hostile. The trans activists do not like my intersex advocacy, I think is the best way to put that. I had a Twitter account and it was not popular with trans activists.
Well, I guess we can talk about that. You've been banned on Twitter. I think you're the second person I've interviewed who's been banned on Twitter. I also interviewed Megan Murphy. It seems to be like almost like a medal. If you know, you should get a medal made banned on Twitter, like they used to have for plays. They would say, banned in Omaha, and that was a sign you were going to go see a play that was a little bit sexier than normal. So I don't really understand why trans activists would be upset by what you were writing. Maybe you can explain a bit more. I'm still not quite getting it.
So, because they use, as we said, they use intersex quite a lot in their argument. Mm-hmm. And my position was that intersex is very different to trans. And also, when they talk about intersex, they talk about it in very vague terms. So they say that we create a spectrum between male and female. Any intersex person who doesn't support that about themselves is considered transphobic because we're not supporting the sort of transgender beliefs about sex.
Right. I mean, it's clear. I mean, one of the problems I have with the extreme transgender rights activists is the denial of biology. But I think that's why I was saying I'm uncomfortable with the word intersex, because it implies that there's a continuum. But in actual fact, maybe everybody, but certainly the vast majority of quote intersex people are clearly on one side or the other. They may, in some cases, have some a woman with some masculine traits, such as higher testosterone and consequent, enlarged clitoris, etc. Or in your case, no masculine traits at all, and the same on the male side of the spectrum. But there's very few, if any, who are that ambiguous that you don't know if they're male or female.
Yeah, it's incredibly rare. The trans activists, they use the 1.7% statistic for intersex, which actually includes 1.5% is actually people who have a late onset condition, so it isn't even present at birth. So those people are definitely unambiguously male or female at birth. And it includes people like myself who are unambiguously male or female. The condition that has the most ambiguity would be mixed gonadal diagenesis, which is where a child is born with a mosaic, so they're XY and XO,
right.
And they usually have ambiguous genitalia as well, and they'll have their gonad tissue is often a mix. They still don't have working sets of both. It's just a mix.
Mm-hmm.
They are the cases that are the hardest sort of sex to be determined, although it can be. But that's incredibly rare. It's such a I've only spoken to one family where that's the condition within the family.
So, can I go back to the 1.5%? So we're talking about 1.5 out of 1.7. So this is the vast majority of so-called intersex. And you were saying late onset. So is this like late onset of puberty, or what are we talking about?
It can be puberty or even later in life. It's another form of CAH, but it doesn't manifest until later in life, often puberty, but it can be as late as in the person's 20s.
So would this be like a woman whose clitoris starts to enlarge during puberty, perhaps, or something like that?
Yeah, they would produce excess testosterone, so they may grow more body hair, that they could virilize slightly, their clitoris, yeah. So it would include that. It also includes males with CIH, though, who don't, as I say, it doesn't have an effect on their phenotype, on their appearance, because excess testosterone doesn't have that effect on males.
I mean, maybe they'll become a bodybuilder when they wouldn't have if they didn't have testosterone or something.
Yeah, maybe or something, yeah.
But it just makes them more male, not less. But, even in those cases, clearly a woman with a bit more body hair is still clearly within the domain of a
female,
woman.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one of the things that I find interesting about this argument of transgender activists is because before transgender became a big thing, there was a lot of talk about non-binary in using pronouns like they instead of he or she. And that was talking about gender as a spectrum. And I don't feel, people would say, I don't feel male or female, so I'm going to be they, I'm going to be neither one nor the other, or somewhat in between, or whatever. But transgender activism is essentially saying it's a very distinct gender binary, and so a transgender woman will act as a woman by, making it look like they have enlarged breasts, by wearing dresses, by putting on lots of makeup. So performing as a very feminine woman, saying that, I've switched from male to female, and reinforcing the gender roles. You know, that women need to wear makeup, that they need to wear dresses.
Yeah, women are feminine, male are masculine, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For years, women, I remember in the 1800s, the lover of Chopin, I think, Georges Sand, if I remember my history, wore trousers. And this shocked the world that a woman wore trousers. But now, of course, I would say most women going about daily life wear trousers, and it's not considered, they're not considered less feminine, or they're not considered less female, let's put it that way.
Yeah, but men, it doesn't seem to work the same way for men, though, does it? I think men, women's clothing has sort of masculinized in that regard. You know, I think I wear jeans most days.
Right.
Men don't seem to have had that same freedom come the other way. I don't, not as many, I don't know, maybe men don't like dresses, but
they can get away with a kilt, right? And it's funny, there's, in my city, there's a group of painters that wear kilts. And I think there's a functional reason, because it's actually easier to work. It's more freeing. And I understand some postmen also wear kilts because it's easier to walk. There's less chafing from the pants and stuff. But apart from that, like a man who wears a dress would be seen as violating the gender norms for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't, it really doesn't work for both sexes in the same way.
No. You've written about an organization that's very well known in England, but not maybe so much outside, called Mermaids. And, you've had some interactions with them?
I haven't I've interacted with people from Mermaids when I had my Swiss account. They're an organization that support trans children. But they're very much of the extreme end of trans activism. So they want surgical interventions for younger children, and they want medical interventions from as early age as possible. I wrote about them mainly because they've influenced so much policy here in the UK, especially in schools.
So what kind of policy?
And I don't, so things like we have, in the UK we actually have one of the few places where we actually have laws about bathroom use. We're supposed to, from the age of 8 and up, we're supposed to provide separate sex bathrooms. Boys and girls. And organizations like Mermaids have gone into schools to do training, and obviously schools listen to them because they're the experts. And they sort of told schools that these regulations don't count. And then have then written guidelines to go into schools to say that a trans child can use whichever bathroom they want to use or whichever changing room they want to use. And then also they've become, there's been some criticism of them from the main, we have one main gender clinic here in the UK for children. And from staff from there have been critical of what they perceive to be pressure from mermaids, and particularly when they, you know, if they have parents referred there who are being supported by mermaids, how they quite aggressively push for medical interventions and don't really want any psychological evaluations to happen or, you know, those kind of discussions before going on to hormones or whatever other options, which is obviously a concern. So, I've written quite a bit about mermaids.
Right.
Well, I don't think they like what I've written about them, but
it's been hard to have a discussion because these organizations have successfully promoted the idea that transgender people are very fragile, and any criticism of what they want is going to harm them. But, you know, in a couple of recent podcasts, I spoke with William Malone, who's an endocrinologist, and he talked about the severe dangers of hormones, of cross-sex hormones. And now more is coming out about the severe adverse effects of puberty blockers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to have this very important medical discussion, like what are the adverse health consequences of transitioning a child early, apart from the psychological issue of should we just wait and see whether this belief that the boy is a girl or vice versa will go away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite interesting as well coming from the intersex point of view, because in the intersex community the move is to try to minimize the any medical intervention with children. And then on the flip side of this, you have the trans activists where it's what they want, that's their campaign. And as I understand it, the majority of children, if left to go through puberty and given the space, do desist from transition.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, but then if they're put on a patch, on a medical pathway, they're more likely to persist. So it seems counterproductive to me to be pushing down a path that then would mean that they continue to be medicalized in adult life, where that could be avoided.
Yeah, William.
Not that there's anything wrong with being trans, just because it's going to be always better to not have to be taking medication if you don't have to.
Yeah, I think that's the concern. William Malone quoted, and I saw the actual study. It's a meta-analysis, so it's like three or four studies put together, but it's something like 85 to 95% of children by the age of 20 will decide that they're not transgender. And it seems like a lot of psychologists are saying that this is kind of a denial on the part of the child that they're actually gay. And so a young girl has essentially lesbian impulses and decides that it's easier to be a transgender male than to come to terms with the fact that she's actually sexually attracted to other girls.
Yeah, because I think it must be quite confusing, especially before you really understand what sexuality is.
Well, yeah,
and all you know is you're not thinking like the other girls. That must be quite a confusing time.
Right. I know one. I guess when I was about 17, I've always been clearly heterosexual, you know, never had any homosexual impulses. But when I was about 17, a younger boy fell in love with me and sent me a letter in lipstick about he wanted to come see me. And I was horrified, and I realized that the problem was that I was scared about my own sexuality. I was, you know, just at 17, I was, you know, not really fully sexually mature. And I wasn't secure enough in my heterosexuality to deal with a friend who was gay and was attracted to me. I just couldn't handle it. So I avoided seeing the person ever again. And I can see if I'd had those sexual attractions, I very well might have, you know, tried to suffocate them.
Yeah, because I there's still not complete acceptance, is there, of homosexuality? So, again, like, if you're getting signals from the world around you that it might not be a good thing, then you might internalize that in a way where you did wish you were the opposite sex, and then it wouldn't matter that you were attracted to boys or to girls, depending on what sex you are. And I think, again, the mermaid thing that's gone into school, because they encourage children from a really young age to start questioning their gender, again, I think that for children who are questioning their sexuality, that's probably quite confusing, that they don't need that idea pushing further onto them, that maybe it is their gender that's the issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it appears that there are some, you know, a minority of children who claim to be the opposite sex when they're young teenagers. A minority will continue to persist with this belief through adulthood. And that's fine if people want to live as transgender, but it seems that, as you said, that's a lifetime medical condition that you've created by this belief, and that should be minimized, especially when children do, in most cases, become comfortable with their sexuality and their sex later.
It would seem, it would seem logical. And I think, especially, there's the one long-term study on transsexual outcomes in adults. And as far as I know, transition doesn't always prove to be the answer either. So I think it's such a drastic measure. It really should be the last resort, shouldn't it? And like a proceed with caution towards the outcome.
Well, especially in a child. I mean, if you're an adult,
and you're sure, then
right. I mean, I'm opposed to plastic surgery because I think, you know, for example, breast enlargement, or you know, women have their labias changed because they don't think their vagina's attractive enough, and, you know, nose jobs and all this kinds of stuff. I'm personally opposed to it, but if other people want to have it, I'm not going to stop them. I mean, if I was asked, I'd give my opinion, but nobody's ever asked me. But for a child, you're making the decision for them if they're 12 or 14, whether they should go on hormones, whether they should get surgery.
Yeah, and I don't think children are capable of really understanding the consequences either. I don't understand how you would talk to a 12-year-old about potential infertility in the future, because I don't think at 12 you can have a concept of what that is and what a life without being able to have your own children would be like. You could quite easily change your mind about that as an adult.
I'm a male. You know, when I was a young teenager, the thought of having children was just a completely theoretical thing. I had no great urge, you know, I didn't think of myself as a dad in the future or anything like that. And when I was married, it sort of took my wife at the age of 25 to say, you know, we should think about having children. And that's okay. That's a good idea. But it was not a big deal. I think if at that time we'd discovered that I was infertile or my wife was infertile, it would have suddenly become a big deal, right? Because now we've got this plan, we will have children and we can't. But I don't see that a 12-year-old or 14-year-old or even a 16-year-old can really make a decision about their fertility.
No, I agree. And it concerns me as well that they really downplay. I looked at WPATH and the presentations they'll do about puberty blocking in children and cross-sex hormones, and they obviously always touch on infertility, and they really downplay the mental health impacts of infertility, because it can have quite serious mental health impacts.
Well, and I guess we can see from the size of the fertility industry just how important it is to adults, that when they discover they're infertile, a lot of people go to pretty drastic measures to have their own child, as opposed to the, you know, seemingly much easier thing of just adopting a child.
Yeah, and we've had it here in the UK with the trans activists as well, because what they want, in addition to treatments that will make people infertile, there are now trans adults who want fertility treatment provided for by the NHS. So again, I find it really hard to square the circle when trans activists who are adults are telling us that it's not a big deal that we're making children infertile, but equally as adults, they are asking for fertility treatments themselves. It's obviously a big deal to them that they're infertile.
Right.
So yes. I would think they would want to preserve the fertility for the children.
Yes, I think that is a big deal, and I think as adults we should not be removing that option from a child when the child clearly is not able to make a mature decision of their own. We're sort of getting a little bit towards the end of our time. One other thing that you said that I found interesting was you said that you had been brought up in a left-wing part of England and you were kind of progressive and left-wing yourself, and you kind of felt that this was very difficult in these circumstances because progressives have generally said trans activists get what they want, otherwise you're transphobic, and it's the conservative right that is saying, you know, wait a minute. So maybe you can comment on the politics of this issue.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think in North America, it's definitely, as you say, that the left wing are the progressives who are in favor of trans activism, and then it's the right people on the right who are against it. The UK is slightly different. Most of the opposition to trans activism has come from left wing women. I don't know why that is. Maybe just left wing women in the UK are, I don't know, maybe we're more objectionable. I don't know why that's happened. But having said that, the majority of the left here are very much in the camp of the trans activists. But it seems to be quite a youth movement, really, I think. So when you look at the left wing, there's a slight divide in terms of generations, maybe, within it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I saw recently that in Ireland... A man, I'm going to call this person a man because they clearly are male, has been housed in a women's prison in Ireland, and I'm not sure if it's in the north or the south, I guess it doesn't really matter, and has been making sexual comments about the women, and of course the way they shower, he can see the women naked and things like that. And the main women's group in Ireland has been silent, and there's been some messages saying, why are you being silent about, you know, women being traumatized by an obvious man being housed in the same prison as them? So I've seen a real split in the feminist movements, and that's true also in Canada, where many so-called feminists are siding with trans activists, but you have the so-called radical feminists like Megan Murphy who are saying, wait a minute, you know, we don't want biological males in our women's only spaces.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing here. We have the radical feminists. The movement of gender critical women here, I think, was definitely started by radical feminists. And then we have the liberal feminists who are, yeah, that trans women are women. That's what they believe. Again, we've been lucky here because we're a smaller country. It's just so much easier in the UK. So we have had new women's groups form who are gender critical, although the main women's groups are, again, in the trans activist camp. But it is quite interesting to see who does and doesn't speak out. We had a similar thing with the prison here. We had a trans woman who was put in women's prisons and raped women in the prison.
Yes.
And there was, again, again with the left wing, just complete silence when that happened.
Which is completely bizarre, given that the left supported feminism against conservatives, you know, for decades, and now women are just being thrown under the bus in circumstances where it's a bit awkward to make a comment.
Because everyone's terrified of the bigot label because it's thrown around so easily, and once that's thrown into it, seems there's no recovering from it. That, you know, it's a label for life.
Yes.
I don't know how you get over that. I think I mean, I just found once I started talking and I was called a bigot a few times, I stopped caring that I was being called a bigot. Because as far as I'm concerned, kind of what I believe hasn't changed. And so I don't know why the only difference between myself and the people who I would have been on the side of before is that I don't believe that sex is made up. I believe it's an actual thing.
I think it's more of an issue with women or other critics who are, say, at a university where the pressure of university committees and investigations can be brought to bear upon them if they cross some line that transgender activists don't like.
We have had quite a bit of doxing and things in the UK, and there are women who've lost their jobs for expressing gender critical views online. There are also women who've been questioned by the police expressing gender critical views online. Again, I can see why that would put people off expressing a gender critical view then, because neither of those things are what we want to happen when we join in with a conversation.
Well, it's an old technique. After a mutiny, the Romans used to line up all the mutinying soldiers, and they'd execute 1 out of 10. And the idea being that the other 9 were never going to mutiny again.
They would remember.
They would remember what had happened to their colleague. Anyway, we've kind of run out of time, and I would just like to thank you for a very interesting discussion. You know, opening the curtain on an important area, and the interactions between intersex and transgender are, I think, interesting and thought-provoking, and it's worth discussion as opposed to trying to shut down discussion.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to speak to someone who wants to have a discussion, because that, as you say, is that these things shouldn't be shut down, and the more they're aired, the more I think we're likely to come to an answer and some kind of agreement, because in the end, something has to...
Yeah, maybe some compromise, discussion and compromise sounds like a good thing.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining me today, Claire.
Thank you very much. It was nice to meet you.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
For feedback this week, I'd like to thank Hey Kian, who made a pledge on Patreon. Jackson Davis, who I interviewed on CO2 and Temperature, said, "I listened to the interview, as did a couple of friends, and we were all pleased and impressed with the outcome and with your broad and deep knowledge of science. Congratulations." Thank you for listening to episode 229 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, a question, or a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, crow with an E. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.